Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. If your company is like most, your future depends in part on technology. Yes, that means choosing the right technology and adopting it quickly. But that isn't enough. To gain advantage, your technology needs to be as outcome-focused as you. That means helping your people be more efficient and more inventive, reducing cost and creating revenue streams, growing your customer base and building trust. Deloitte combines world-class business knowledge with a full command of technology to help clients do more than choose cloud or adopt AI. They help them create advantage from it. Read case studies at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage. Support for this show comes from Wix Studio. Designers and devs, you might be able to do your thing better on Wix Studio, a web platform with everything you need to deliver bespoke sites hyper-efficiently. Design teams get a ton of smart features that can take the grind out of web creation without it costing per-pixel control. Dev teams, you get a zero-setup, developer-first environment combined with an AI code assistant and your preferred IDE for rapid deployment. Search Wix Studio today to explore the full range of features.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my show about big ideas and other problems. Today, I'm talking to Dropbox CEO Drew Houston. Drew co-founded Dropbox way back in 2007, and he's among the last of the founder CEOs from that era still standing. 17 years is a long time to be with one company, and you'll hear us talk about all the change he's seen in the industry. Now, Dropbox seems like a simple idea. Cloud storage is something all of us rely on now in some way, but it wasn't always like that. You'll hear Drew talk about the early days when Apple tried to acquire Dropbox, and Steve Jobs pretty derisively told him and his co-founder that Dropbox was, quote, a feature, not a product. Apple's own iCloud Drive exists. So do Google Drive and Microsoft OneDrive. But Dropbox has managed to fend them all off, something Drew attributes to working well across platforms, instead of trying to lock you into one company's ecosystem. But as Drew looked to the future, he decided to make a big bet on what else? AI. And turn Dropbox's platform-agnostic approach into something that helps people stay organized across devices and browsers. There's a lot of AI hype out there, and it's clear that Drew is an AI optimist, but he has a refreshingly clear take about what AI is right now, as opposed to what it might be in a decade, and how winding the path from today to the future actually is. Right now, as Drew points out, the value from AI mostly goes to NVIDIA. But he's pretty sure that's going to change, and the rest of us will come along for the ride. You'll also hear us talk about how Dropbox, an entire company whose products make remote life easier, has reinvented its entire concept of virtual work after COVID. The company is almost completely remote now, and Drew and I talked a lot about how he made that decision and the benefits and drawbacks he's seen from it. Drew's seen a lot over the past 17 years, and he's pretty direct with his thoughts about the industry. I think you're really going to like this one. Okay, Dropbox CEO Drew Houston. Here we go. Drew Houston, you are the co-founder and CEO of Dropbox. Welcome to Decoder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I got to tell the audience, this is a very special episode because Drew is in the studio with me.
I am.
We're looking at each other. Usually Decoder we do remote because, you know, people are all over the place. Time zones are weird. But you and I are together, which means there's going to be a lot of cross-talking about AI. I can just feel it coming.
Awesome.
I feel like people are fairly familiar with Dropbox. It's a file syncing service. It's been around for a long time. You've been the CEO the whole time, which is unusual. That's quite a journey. I want to talk about it all. But give us your view of what Dropbox is now.
I mean, in a lot of ways, Dropbox is solving the 2024 version of the problem I started with back in 2007. So when I started Dropbox, I started because I kept forgetting my thumb drive, emailing myself files, all the things we used to have to do. But that was really under this bigger problem I had of like, my stuff is everywhere, I can't find it. In the beginning, the solution to that looked like, oh, well, I should sync my files to the cloud and across all these different devices that with different operating systems that don't talk to each other. But fast forward to today, we have a lot of the same problems, right? My stuff is everywhere. I can't find it. A lot of things are different. So what used to be 100 files on my desktop is now 100 tabs in my browser. Or like actually both, you have 100 files on your desktop and 100 tabs in your browser. And a lot of that's for good reason because we have all these amazing new tools. But I think there's also a sense that maybe we've gotten too much of a good thing and we have a very fragmented and cluttered environment. And then this creates a bunch of problems, this kind of death by a thousand paper cuts. And some like really important experiences have gone backwards. So just an example, take something like search, right? Search was actually better 20 years ago than it was today when it comes to like searching your stuff or your company stuff, because you just search your hard drive, maybe your email, but that was kind of it. But now, like, bizarrely, we live in this world where it's easier to search all of human knowledge with a Google search, right, than your own stuff or your company's knowledge. And when you go to work, you have like 10 search boxes, not one. So we're thinking a lot about these problems. Like, how do we evolve Dropbox beyond file syncing to organize all your cloud stuff? There's a lot we're doing with the core Dropbox app to do that. And then we've also been introducing new products like Dropbox Dash, which is AI-powered universal search. It works not just with your files, but it'll search your Google Docs, your email, your Slack, your Salesforce. All of your different apps have one search bar that searches everything. And then a lot that we're doing with AI and really personalizing AI and being able to answer a lot of the questions that ChatGPT can't. So if you think about questions like, you know, when does my lease expire? Or, you know, where's a slide from last year's product launch where we talked about that? The ChatGPT can't answer these questions because it's not connected to your stuff. But that's really what we do at Dropbox. We've always been platform agnostic and trusted, and we can build a lot of that capability because Dropbox is already connected to your most important information. So in a lot of ways, just we're back to the fundamentals of like how in 2024 or, you know, 2027, 2030, what's the best way to search and organize and share content in a world that's today really fragmented? And how do we fill in this, these missing pieces, like giving you search back, helping you organize your stuff, making it easier to share things in a mixed format. So if you have like a Google Doc and a 10 gig 4K video, there's not really a, and an Airtable and a web, you know, link to a website or something. There's not really a common container that holds all of that. So that's a bit of a snapshot of the fundamental problems we're working on are really just around how do you organize and share and secure your content.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. I actually want to hold on this idea of a universal container for 1 second.
Sure.
Because I am kind of fascinated about people's relationship to information and how it's stored.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories we did years ago now was about college students who didn't know how file systems work. And their STEM professors had to like stop and not actually like teach astronomy for a day and teach them how the file system on a Windows computer works so they could like use the radio telescope, which was generating files and putting them in a file system. And, you know, people have like a lot of feelings about that. But that's sort of related to a generation of people who grew up with totally abstracted file systems on iPhones, on iPads, on Chromebooks, on whatever. And you don't even think about that anymore. And you have this core feature, which is syncing files across multiple platforms in the cloud. And now you're saying I need to expand that to all kinds of things. And I think about those things, and there's nothing about that that says that is the same file system or information structure at all. Like the stuff in my Slack, I don't think if Slack is generating files in any way, shape, or form, really. And Google Docs is a file, but it's totally abstracted versus a photo from my phone, which is a file but is equally abstracted. How do you think about synthesizing all of that?
Well, I think it's kind of going back to first principles, just recognizing like, wait, it doesn't have to be like this. Right? And sometimes you can look at history, and I don't mean like history. I'm just like, it actually always wasn't like this. Like, you know, in the physical world, you would go to sleep and you'd wake back up and the papers on your desk are still there, right? And with your computer, when you reboot your computer, the files are still there. But when you're in the browser realm, like, once you get to, you know, to 100 tabs, you either like nuke the whole browser and clear everything out because you're declaring like tab bankruptcy and you're just overwhelmed, or your operating system updates itself in a weird way that where you lose everything. But I think, yeah, a whole generation of people are like growing up without this like basic idea, like it should be possible to organize your stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be mayhem. And so there are these problems hidden in plain sight like that. So like search is one example, but organizing is another. When you think about the web world just evolved without really a container concept, right? And which is bizarre because like files have folders, songs have playlists, links have, you know, there's not really an answer to that. And I think we'll look back on that and be like, that was really weird. And then you think about also in addition to just like the fundamental container, like how do you have, you know, a universal container? There's also intelligence, right? When you use Netflix or Spotify or YouTube, like even when you sign up as a new user, the system's smart. It knows what the world likes to watch or listen to, and then it presents you good options. But then when you go to work, there's really no intelligence in that system. And like, you can't even like wrap your arms around where is your stuff, or because it lives in 10 different places. And in the consumer realm, yeah, the system's always learning from you. You're not even like filing things away. It's just like curating your experience, yeah. Right? You just watch stuff.
Do you think that's good or bad? I'm like, I'm honestly, sure. I mean that question sincerely.
Yeah.
Dropbox started as you will have a file system in the cloud mm-hmm. that will be expressed natively on whatever device you're on. It'll look like a folder on Mac OS.
Yeah.
It'll look like a folder on Windows.
Yeah.
And we're just extending this concept to the cloud, and that's really powerful. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of at this place where it's people don't even know the file systems exist.
Yeah.
And the most productive people that I can think of are in control of their files and folders. They like think about it. They have naming conventions for all the files they might need to make whatever document they need to produce in the end. And then there's the class of people that are just like, it's chaos and I search Google Drive. And I can't tell if we did a good thing by abstracting away the file system.
Well, I think what was great about the file system, you know, in the beginning was like that was where all your stuff was. So it was like a single source of truth. Everything worked out of the file system. And so we've created a number by solving one set of problems, like, well, files have limitations. Like you can't real-time collaborate. You know, we use things like Google Docs because you get all these real-time collaboration and the browser brings a lot of benefits. But then we kind of like fractured the whole stack because like the web world and filed world don't talk to each other. As we're just covering, like the web world doesn't really have persistence or organization. And, you know, any way you look at it, I think about like, all right, you know, I open my laptop in 2027, you know, and I want to get to my work stuff. What do I see? Like, hopefully we can do better than like literally the finder, like one finder window open that was like literally hasn't changed since like 1984. And then a browser with like 100 tabs sprayed across the top. To the point where like you can't even see text or titles anymore. Like I think we can do better from a UX standpoint. And I think these things do get better. And there are a couple examples I think about. Like one is, I mean, think about TV, right? The way TV evolved, like first it was like broadcast over the air, maybe 10 channels. That was great. Then you get basic cable and then you're like 30 channels. And then, but then somewhere along the way from like 100 to 1,000 channels, like it sort of lost the plot. You're like, I just want to watch the Super Bowl, but like, why am I paging through all this like music for, you know, channels at a time? Like what is going on? And, you know, Comcast just thought they were giving people what they want. We're asking for, like, I just want more channels, more stuff. Right. But it turned out what we needed wasn't the next 1,000 channels. What we really needed was something like Netflix or these smart, rethought system where it's like designed to scale up to millions of things in the catalog and gives you access to all of them. But the user interface uses primarily machine learning to recommend, to identify what you want and recommend things. It's just and gets rid of a lot of the constraints of linear TV. So I think we're kind of in that like 1,000 productivity tools era when we really need a rethought system and a rethought environment. And I think there's a lot to learn from those kinds of evolutions. I mean, TV is one example. You could say the same thing about music. Right. And like MP3s, you used to play them out of folders. And then Apple's like, hang on, this is dumb. We should just have a music catalog and iTunes. It should be by artists and album and everything. And then Spotify's like, hang on, why should I have to like buy these songs one at a time? I should just have an infinity everything catalog. And then there were like new generations after that. It's like, well, it's anything I listen to or watch, like should all be together. And there's this whole continuum of intelligent experiences ranging from, you know, you can still use Spotify as an iTunes-style catalog and manually curate everything. You can go all the way to the other end of the spectrum and be like just AI DJ, just press play. But then a lot of stuff in between, like, oh, this artist radio, genre radio. So I think there's just – when you look at the consumer realm, there's just this whole rich ecosystem of different ways that you can solve these problems. Then you go to your, you know, your desktop at work or your workspace, and there's just none of that intelligence or design has made its way over. So we see that as a huge opportunity for Dropbox to rethink this.
I feel like I could spend the entire rest of the show talking about how much better my relationship to music was when I was individually editing ID3 tags on MP3s. I will not do that, but just rest assured I could. So let's talk about, you know, that's a big vision in the future. Dropbox today, the core business is still selling people cloud storage. How is that split?
Dropbox has about 18 million subscribers, $2.5 billion in revenue, free cash flow. It's mostly people using Dropbox at work. So about 80% of people who use Dropbox or are subscribers are like, I use it for work, or I use it for a, you know, mixed personal and work use case. We certainly have a lot of folks who have used Dropbox over the years to like share photos or for their personal lives. But we really thought the problems that weren't solving themselves were in the kind of work universe, and a lot of the sort of paper cuts I just described are a lot more acute in the working environment than at home. And so we're about 2,600 people. We're 90% remote. We have this virtual first working model that has been awesome for us. And Dropbox is, we compete with folks like Microsoft and Google, and with all the office suites, there's usually, you can get OneDrive or you can get Google Drive. But a lot of why people use Dropbox today is because it's platform agnostic. So if you do a lot of our customers do a lot of external sharing with clients, or if you run a marketing agency or something, you're interacting with like dozens of different organizations. Dropbox is the best at doing that because it just sort of works on every platform, regardless of what your clients or partners are using. Big files, right? Video production, creative community. Long Dropbox has been kind of standard there because we handle big file syncing and just that volume of data better than anyone else. And we've built a really great like trust relationship and really focus on ease of use and security, privacy. You know, we're uncomplicated in that we're not trying to advertise against your data. We're just focused on taking care of your stuff. So that's a little bit of a snapshot of where we are today. And then we see expanding to all your cloud stuff or all of your content as a natural extension of where we started, which is taking care of all your important files.
The thing you described where you compete against OneDrive or Google Drive, even I imagine to some extent the iCloud features. There's a very famous story from the beginning of Dropbox where Steve Jobs tried to acquire the company. You said no, and he's like, I'm going to kill you. But just integrating this in...
Good times.
You want to tell that story real quick?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, Dropbox was scaling like crazy because my co-founder, Arash, and I just started the company kind of out of... wasn't literally out of a dorm room, but kind of looked like one. But we just had this idea. It took off. And then we were scaling virally because we had this freemium model where people would spread Dropbox. And so we got the attention of all the big platform companies, and we were invited to come down and meet Steve. And it was, I mean, I remember like we were, Arash and I jump in a zip car from our apartment in San Francisco, and we're like driving down to One Infinite Loop in Cupertino. And, you know, you walk in and you're like, we're here to see Steve Jobs. <You know? laughs> And they're like, have a seat. Yeah. And we go in the boardroom and Steve comes in and he like starts his pitch. He's like, hey, you guys should, you know, we're like a startup with infinite resources and you should really throw in with us. And here's why, da, da, da. And, you know, we were having a great time building the company. And for a lot of reasons, we were just like, we admire everything that Apple's done. We'd love to find any way to work together, but we're having a great time building this company independently. And I'm like, I'm sure you understand. I don't think he loved that response. He's like, you're a feature, not a product. You know, you don't have distribution. You don't have this or that. You don't control the operating system. And I was like, all right, agree to disagree. Because, I mean, every pair of companies has this issue, too. Like, Apple controls Apple stuff, but they don't control Google stuff. They don't control Microsoft stuff and vice versa. And that is exactly why Dropbox exists in the first place, is to go across all the platforms. But, yeah, no, it was intense. Like, you know, the story, that was, like, 2009. But to see, like, Steve on stage in 2011, you know, at WWDC, launching iCloud, calling us out by name... And then that was just the beginning of a whole competitive period where, you know, we're just sort of drafted up to the big leagues and fighting with not just Apple, but Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Facebook, like literally, and then, you know, a raft of other companies in our space. So, yeah, that you get sort of your hazing ritual as you get bigger.
So that line, you're a feature, not a product, I've heard this issued as a criticism of maybe half of the startups I've covered.
Yeah.
And so, mostly it's true, right? Like, they are features, and then they get Sherlocked into an operating system or integrated into some other thing, and they disappear or they get acquired or something. That has not been true for Dropbox. 17 years now, and you're still a CEO.
That's right.
Why do you think you've managed to persist?
A bunch of things. I mean, first is the nature of our problems. Yeah, we need this platform agnostic way of managing all of our stuff. And like, we're just, yeah, maybe in the 90s you had sort of the Windows, Intel, like monoculture, but that's just not our reality anymore. I mean, the truth is like, we all have accounts on all of these things. And we've had to get a lot clearer and more focused about where is the value we provide, right? If we're just storage, then that you're right. That's not like a strategic – that might be a feature. That's not that strategic, or it's a commodity or whatever. And we'd hear those criticisms. And you know, often I wouldn't like necessarily disagree, but I'd be like, wait, like, but our business keeps growing. And actually our revenue per user keeps going up, not down. That's a weird commodity, for example. And then – a lot of it was just talking to our customers, and often they would just, or they would say things that sort of tripped some wire in my head. Like, for example, they're like, yeah, I'm not like Dropbox doesn't just keep my files in sync. It keeps my team in sync, or it keeps people in sync, or it's like, it's where I go to work. Like it's my workplace. That kind of threw, you know, over the years, I would like comments like that would stick. We're like, wait, okay, that's a super interesting I guess that's maybe the kind of thing that maybe I might have misunderstood or Steve misunderstood. It's like, wait, yeah, we're not selling storage. We're actually – it's really the sharing, or it's the fact that we can be your digital environment. That's what people were buying, and then they're just like, oh, there's just one problem. Like Dropbox was never really purpose-built for that. But what if it were? And so we decided to really focus on collaboration and like lean into our advantages in terms of being platform agnostic and trust and, you know, not advertising against your content and things like that. And fundamentally, like we've also really care about keeping the experience easy to use and taking care of our customers. And so we still have a, you know, loyal base of a double-digit million number of subscribers. And then there's a lot – we have a very strong foundation we're building on.
So Dropbox is fundamentally in the business of selling storage, right? You buy hard drives in the cloud and then people put their files on it. Do you ever see the budget for hard drives? Like, does someone show up in your office and is like, we have to buy 10 more hard drives today? What is that like?
Oh, yeah. Capacity planning. Sure. No, it's a – I mean, we have a
– fancier term for it.
Yeah. We have a phenomenal team that manages all of our technical infrastructure, including all the procurement and operation of our data centers and hardware and things
but
like
that. But do you ever pick up the phone to like Western Digital or Seagate?
Yeah,
and
totally.
Like,
yeah.
Say, I need 2,000 hard drive stat.
Not like a trading floor, but like – but totally. Yeah. No. And, you know, we have to manage our whole supply, not just hard drives, but servers and all the networking, all the elements of the stack. So for sure, we have to go many, many levels down kind of to the metal. And you know, we're in the business of storage or hard drives the same way that Apple's in the business of like glass and aluminum. It's like, yeah, that those are ingredients, but that's not really what people are buying. Like people are buying like having all of my stuff in one place or being able to search it, being able to share. So it's really – and this is like a refinement that I've had to do over the years because initially I was like, yeah, we sell storage. We sync your files. But then when we saw like, oh, wait, what space do we really occupy in our customers' minds? Their description is often very different. Like you help me run my business, you help me make my album, or you help me produce my videos, or like basically get a livelihood. And we're, you know, and that always sort of sends us thinking about things differently when we better understand how people actually feel about Dropbox and what they're really hiring us to do.
When you think about your set of competitors now, I can name like a bunch of weird companies. DocuSign is probably a competitor to Dropbox in some meaningful way, right? Who do you think of as your biggest competitors?
It's really the Office suites because, you know, 100% of our customers are going to have either, you know, Office or Google Workspace. Certainly for like file syncing, share our kind of dominant category. The biggest competitive challenge is one that there's a free, there's something bundled with each of the suites. And then second, like, you know, we're 17 years in, and so the category has matured to some extent. So there's not like some new continent of people who like haven't heard of Dropbox or syncing or something. And so on the one hand, that is true. But then you look at the problems we've been talking about. We're like, yeah, the cloud world has like no good solutions to these problems. It's super fragmented. You know, the UX is flawed in all these ways, and there's all this opportunity to sort of bring in a lot of the stuff that is proven to work on the consumer side into the productivity realm. You know, zero customers have these problems solved. There's a billion knowledge workers, right? It's a huge opportunity in front of us.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Support for Decoder comes from Mint Mobile. Imagine you're at a very fancy, expensive restaurant. And as you're browsing the menu, wondering how you'll afford anything on it, you notice the filet mignon is a mere $10. At first you think jackpot, but then you immediately think, wait, what's the catch? Now, what do suspiciously cheap steaks have to do with your cell phone bill? Well, we're used to seeing quote-unquote great deals from overpriced wireless providers and also thinking, what's the catch? But with Mint Mobile, there is no catch. For a limited time, their wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You can get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month. Go to mintmobile.com/decoder. That's mintmobile.com/decoder. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/decoder. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on an unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Support for Decoder comes from How I Built This, from Wondery. Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies and learns how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. It can be a how-to guide for navigating the challenges of life and business from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more business content like this, listen on Wondery, a destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Dropbox CEO Drew Houston about the draw of offices and how he made the decision to reinvent his entire company to be remote first.
So let's do the decoder questions and just talk about how Dropbox is organized, and then let's talk about how you're going after these problems. You said 2,600 people, you're all remote. That was like a big Dropbox moment.
Yeah.
How is the company structured?
Before the pandemic, we were kind of classic tech company, huge office in San Francisco, you know, mostly Bay Area.
Like a really fancy office.
Super nice.
There's a rumor that your cafeteria had a Michelin star.
He should have. That was always something we had hoped to do. But yeah, we had this awesome space, this awesome food, this just incredibly vibrant in-person community. Then COVID happens. And so I think that sort of turned everybody upside down. And, you know, first we were sort of preoccupied with the challenge of all of that and the sort of trauma that everybody's going through. But then, as we thought about it, we're like, hey, wait, this is like the nature of, well, first of all, like we all just went remote overnight and this like forced migration to, you know, this forced beta test of hybrid distributed work. And it worked a lot better than we thought. People loved not commuting, the flexibility to live anywhere. And for the first time since this idea, since the concept first arose in probably like the 50s or 60s, like you could actually work from anywhere. And the stars had aligned in a really terrible way. But like one of the silver linings is like, hey, we can actually decouple work from our physical environment, which can have a lot of benefits. And so we're like, hey, the floorboards have been ripped up. This is really chaotic. But like we don't have to put them down the same way. And so there's a huge opportunity to really be able to design the work experience in ways that, you know, our parents never could. So we thought about this. I mean, and then as a practical matter, people were like, can I move? What are we going to do after lockdown? Can I move away? Can I not? Am I going to have to commute? And so we thought about it like, all right, well, you know, there is no substitute for the in-person experience and meeting face-to-face. Like our biological wiring isn't going to change. That said, you can get a lot done on Zoom. So how do we get the best of both worlds? How do we give people that flexibility but also keep the human part, the team cohesion, and build relationships and trust and all the things that are hard to do on Zoom? And also, how do we avoid the worst of both worlds, which is sort of this, all right, 2-3 days, this sort of hybrid compromise, like 2-3 days a week, where the problem with that, I mean, there are many problems with that, but one is like you're still like on a leash to whatever the office space is. You can't live outside commuting distance. Maybe you're commuting less, but you're still spending a lot of time in a car or a train or whatever, which is a totally dead time. And then if it's the same 2 days a week, then that's great because everybody's there, but then it's like super inefficient. You know, your CFO is like, I don't really love paying for, you know, a 70% vacant office space. And if it's unsynchronized, it's like totally self-defeating because then you're like commuting to a half-empty office. What's the point? And then what's happened since is like even worse. It's like, well, I'm commuting to a half-empty office to literally be back in the same Zoom meeting,
yep,
which I can come back to.
This is my personal nightmare.
Yeah. And so we're like, first it's just like thinking about this from first principles. And for me, a lot of my heroes are like the tech founders and that you'd imagine. But then also a lot of my heroes are like the management thinkers, right? The Peter Drucker or Deming or Alfred Sloan, Henry Ford, people like that. And, you know, I think a lot of that, like Drucker would have looked at this and be like, there's a huge opportunity here to like rethink this. And so we thought about it. We're like, yeah, we studied all the remote first companies. We decided not to be 100% remote because you lose the in-person part. We decided to be 90%, then 10% is really kind of a more concentrated dose of human connection. So like really don't just do like Zoom things when you're together mm-hmm. as you would in an office. Like really think about, you know, when you think about the most memorable experiences in your working career, it's usually not like some windowless conference room at, you know, or daily stand-up. It's like when you're off in some nice place or can kind of zoom out a little bit. And so that's what we basically studied all the remote first companies. We synthesized all the findings into our own way of working called Virtual First. We open sourced it. So all of the stuff here is you can see on our web, just search for Virtual First in Dropbox and we'll tell you how it works. It was a full send. Like we're like, this is October 2020, right? A lot of other companies were like, we'll tell you in 3 months, every 3 months. Like I didn't know that was an option. But we really felt like, well, we owe it to our employees, like give them clarity about their lives and help like unblock these big decisions around where they live and how this is going to work. But that also meant like torching all of the in-person, like all the stuff I talked about before, like where we came from, this super vibrant in-person culture, like that meant just like permanently torching that for this like speculative idea that we couldn't even like really put into practice until lockdown ended. So yeah, that was a pretty wild decision. But fast forward today, it really works. Like people were 90% remote. We used to have 75% of our employees in the big tech hubs. Now that's like 50%. So that means we've gotten all these awesome people in these places that never would have joined Dropbox before, like at all levels. So places like Boston and LA and Chicago went from like zero people working there to now all those places have like 100 or, you know, or hundreds.
Do they go into offices together? They're all working from home?
Nope. Yeah, we don't ask people to commute to any office. I mean, we'll do a lot of in-person programming of different kinds, and we also allow people to kind of self-organize. And we do have like hubs where we do have some space. So, you know, in San Francisco, we still have we converted our offices into what we call studios. So basically, we ripped out all the individual workstations and things like that and turned all of our offices into these convening and collaborative spaces that are really designed more for that like human connection piece called studios. That said, I think the utilization has been pretty low.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your CFO. Is he still pretty mad that you got a bunch of empty office space?
Well, I mean, it's tough for, you know, I don't think there's anybody that's, there's a lot of vacant office space in San Francisco. So yeah. I don't think we're alone in that. We have managed to sublet a lot of it. I mean, mostly we're just following we see our employees as our customers. Like if they, you know, we'll support however they want to gather, but we're finding that these like retreats and offsites and things like that are often a lot more effective than asking people to commute.
Do you think the big fancy office and the perks and the chef who should have got a Michelin star, was that just zero interest rate VC? Like you've been at it for a long time. Like you're one of the few CEOs here who's been the CEO of a company through all the stages for almost two decades. And that there was a particular kind of excess in those early moments.
Yeah.
That is gone. Is that just pure zero interest rate phenomenon? Is that something else that's changed?
I think that's right. I think it's a zero interest rate phenomenon combined with kind of the pre-COVID world where, you know, the reason why it was easier to get five people in an office 5 days a week is because they didn't have an option. Yeah. Like this whole flexibility thing wasn't in the cards. And so I think that's what a lot of CEOs today kind of misunderstand. They sort of think of like, you know, they keep mashing the go back to 2019 button and they're like, it's not working. And then they just push harder and then you have this really kind of toxic relationship. You know, and yeah, I don't see that coming back. I mean, I think the market will tell us eventually, like actually if it is really the profitable way and best way to get great talent to have these to kind of go back to 2015 or something, like maybe, but I don't think so.
That was the argument back then, right? Is we need to have these perks because in order to hire talent in these places, Google has water slides and Facebook will buy you a Picasso. And if we don't do these perks and give away the massages and the food, then no one will come work here.
Yeah.
Do you think that was true? I wonder if that was actually true.
It was true. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean, so I think a lot of we experienced the biggest war for talent that will probably, you know, certainly I've ever seen in my working lifetime over that period. If you have two equal options, you're going to take and then this one has all these like cushy stuff, like you can understand how that would resonate with people. It created a lot of problems too, even in that world. You get sort of a sense of like complacency or entitlement that's problematic if you want to keep scaling your company and really compete. So I think there were some hard lessons learned on that front that a lot of it is unhealthy. But I think now people, you know, people have voted with their feet that they value the flexibility a lot more than, you know, snacks in the office. And then, by the way, like at home, you can sort of set up your environment exactly how you want it. And, yeah. you know, not just have snacks, but like your dog and, you know, something that's totally purpose built for you. And so, yeah, I think like forcing people back into the office is sort of like trying to force people back into movie theaters or something. Like, yeah, maybe you can do it for like Top Gun like once, but it's just like not, you know, or getting people back into malls or something. It was cool. Like, you know, movie theaters were great and malls were great for their time, but it's just, you know, the world has moved on.
Yeah. How is Dropbox actually structured now? So you went to this fully virtual situation, you gather people together, but how is the actual company organized?
I mean, pretty conventionally. I think we, you know, on my team, I have a couple of GM. I have a GM of my core business, a GM of Dropbox Dash, which is our universal search product and a lot of what I was talking about with organizing all your cloud stuff, all of our customer-facing functions like sales and marketing, and then all of our G&A functions. So pretty typical kind of tech organization where you have like business units that are really around product development and then these horizontal functions around going to market, around G&A, so like finance and legal people. That's a tougher metamorphosis than it sounds, because I think that the basic scaling challenge that you have as you start is you start by building, everybody's kind of artisanally crafting a great product together. And then as CEO, as you're really building a company, you have to do this metamorphosis from just like working on a product to like building a machine that repeatedly builds products in a super competitive environment. And so that's like the journey we've been on over the last several years, is like really getting to that second act. And there are parts where we've done a lot of stuff well. There's parts where we've had a ton of challenges. But with things like AI and a lot of the new doors that are open now, it's a super exciting period.
This is the decoder question. You've made a lot of decisions. You're making some decisions about what to invest in now. How do you make decisions? What's your framework?
Carefully, in a pretty structured way, actually. So we had to think about this a lot, especially as we moved to virtual first and during lockdown and so on. And when we studied a lot of the remote first companies, one thing was very clear. It is not a good idea to just like take what you're doing in person and try to like photocopy that or just try to do the same thing on Zoom. Otherwise, you're just like in meetings all the time and you just have to operate differently. And then Jeff Bezos, like one quote from him stuck with me, which was that when someone asked him, like, what's the single best decision you've ever made in your career at Amazon? His response, I mean, like, he could give a lot of answers to that, but his response was like, the best decision I ever made was banning PowerPoint in my company and shifting to this narrative-based memo culture. And I think that's super important both in general and especially in a distributed and remote world. And so like, well, why is that? That seems like very specific. Like, what's the difference? And there are a lot of reasons. So a PowerPoint, it's not as much about the ideas as much as presentation. It's a very slow method of communicating. Like, people can read a lot faster than they can talk. I mean, we've all been in those endless deck meetings where like someone asks a question and that's addressed two slides later if we could just get there. And then Amazon pioneered this model of like, they write 6-page memos. It's kind of awkward when you start. They actually start the first 20 minutes of every meeting being completely silent and sort of study halling a document. But then there are enormous benefits of that, which are writing forces a clarity of thought that a PowerPoint doesn't. Because you can sort of smear a few bullets on a PowerPoint and sort of be done. But to really crystallize your thoughts is a very challenging process. And it's tough for the writer, but it makes it much better for the reader. And there's a lot more readers than writers, right? So you know that after that 20 minutes or half hour or whatever, like, everybody is completely on the same page. They all are sort of have the same like high def picture of like, what is the problem we're focused on? What is the decision we're making? The teams had to already pre-do a lot of the work to get alignment that results in that narrative. So just, you know, in 10 different ways, you get much higher quality and faster decisions through a narrative culture or through this like practice of like memos and writing and documenting. And when we studied the remote first companies, like most of them were like, yeah, you have to like document a lot more to be efficient.
So are you doing this? The meetings start with 20 minutes of silence while you read the 6-page memos?
Yeah. And Amazon was really smart about how they thought about scale more broadly. So memos are one example, but then how you structure your senior team. Like, if you do this memo thing, you can actually have a larger executive team because you don't have as many people talking over each other. And there's a great book called Working Backwards by two former Amazon execs, Bill and Colin, who we actually worked with them to deploy a lot of these Amazon practices within Dropbox. And, you know, we customize them a bit. You can't totally just like photocopy stuff into your company. But we adapted a lot of it, and we've made it work really well. And I think it's helped us be a lot more efficient. It's not a panacea. I think it's really hard. It's really challenging for a lot of people to build that muscle and like write well. It takes a lot of time. So that's often a struggle. And you can sort of lose the plot where you sort of like over-index on the document more than the decision you're making. So you have to put some guardrails in to constrain how much it becomes about document writing versus like just moving. But in aggregate, it's been a hugely helpful process for us.
I do like it when a company's culture trends into memo warfare. There's a particular kind of very entertaining passive aggressiveness that you can see express itself, which is I find very entertaining. I used to work at AOL. That's all I'm saying. That's the only thing I'll say about that. But give me an example of how you turn that into decision making, right? Because I ask this question a lot. Amazon comes up a lot. They have the famous type one, type two mm-hmm. decisions about one-way doors and two-way doors. But the connection between, okay, I've taken that, I've taken some of this culture, and this is how I make decisions, mm-hmm. I find it often to be quite fuzzy. So
yeah.
Walk me through how you actually make decisions.
So, I mean, actually that virtual first, that full send that I talked about, October 2020, I think we're the first company I can think of that really put forward a one-way door and like strong perspective on what's life going to be like after lockdown. And I can walk you through how that happened. So we really formalized the Amazon memo culture in the last like couple of years. That wasn't like the first time we used documents for decision-making. Yeah. So, you know, we had a lot of discussions about potential futures or like what's life going to be like after COVID. And there was kind of a period where we're kind of all brainstorming and trying to figure out different things. But then when it's like, all right, we really have to figure out a working model. I can still remember, we all were on Zoom. You know, I was in like a room above my garage in a summer place in New Hampshire in this like shed, basically. And I just remember all the, you know, tiles of faces as we're like making this. Like, do we just torch our entire company culture and just like put and just pray that this.
Did you find in that moment that you were spending more time with more people, but you felt more alone? So, that was like that was a very like personal experience to me, but I was like, I'm talking to more people than I talk to, like all the time.
Totally.
Like we're all on the grid all the time. 30 people are always here now.
Yeah.
But I'm more lonely than I've been in forever.
And that goes back to our wiring, right? The sense of relief we all got when lockdown ended and you could like meet with people again. And again, like it's remote is great and the flexibility is awesome, but there's no substitute for that, right? And if you want to build relationships with people, build trust, which is super important. You know, you can sustain relationships on Zoom. You can't build relationships on Zoom, or like most people can't. So yeah, it is a very isolating and fatiguing experience. And I think, you know, it's a lot more than just memo culture or one or two things. Like there's this whole set of practices that we do to make virtual first effective. And so part of it is like the in-person gathering. The second is like ways to curtail meeting load, right? When people are in different time zones, like you could sort of end up with meeting sprawl morning through night. So we have this like core collaboration hours concept where we try to meetings within a common like 4-hour period. And so there's a lot of things you have to do like that to really think about the work week and how do you optimize it for people. And there are different modes of work, right? There's face-to-face is one mode. It's good for certain things. There's Zoom is – you can get a lot done on Zoom. You know, memos are another – your memos or narratives are another mode of working. Then there's like Slack and the whole kind of communication mayhem. That's another mode of working. And they all have different strengths and weaknesses. So it's really how do you match the task to the right mode and design these things? And that's, you know, I guess the rabbit hole goes pretty deep on like what you have to do to operate effectively in a distributed world. But yeah, with that virtual first decision, we frame the options in a document and it's like, all right, we could do, you know, this virtual first thing. We could go back to the office. We could do the 2-3 days a week thing. And I mean, honestly, the discussion took like 10 or 15 minutes. For like probably the most consequential decision that we've ever, that at least I could remember making in terms of its impact on people's like on the company's culture and everybody's lives, you know, but it was just very clear. It was like, yeah, this is none of these other options are going to be tenable. Like going back to the office isn't going to work. This 2 days a week thing isn't going to work. So this is really the only thing that's left. And we went for it and never looked back. And I think we also got lucky. I mean, sometimes you make a big one-way door decision and you went through the wrong way, wrong door, but it's really worked for us. So like our employee retention is way up. Engagement is way up. We don't have any of these problems with people commuting or, you know, we can get great talent from anywhere, as I was saying. And employees love the flexibility is like a trump card. So like our offer accept rates are way higher. I mean, there's a lot of other factors with like the market and everything else, but it has been phenomenally successful for us.
We have to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll be jumping right into the thing that's on absolutely everyone's minds this year, AI.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and this is Unlocking Us. In this podcast, we'll explore ideas, stories, experiences, research, books, films, music, anything that reflects the universal experiences of being human, from the bravest moments to our most brokenhearted moments. Some episodes will be conversations with the people who are teaching me, challenging me, confusing me, maybe ticking me off a little bit. And some days I'll just talk directly to you about what I'm learning and how it's changing the way I think and feel. The first episodes are out now. We're going to do 3 or 4 part series every quarter, so about 12 to 15 episodes a year. Unlocking Us will always drop on Wednesdays. And now you can find me wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. You can get new episodes as soon as they are published by following Unlocking Us on your favorite podcast app. And as always, stay awkward, brave, and kind.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America. The endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm back with Dropbox CEO Drew Houston talking about one of the worst decisions any leader has to make, when to cut staff, and how he plans to tackle the AI-driven future. You made a harder decision about almost a year ago, right? You were growing. You've got a lot of happy employees. You maybe grew too fast. You laid off about 500 people, 16% of the company. And you had this quote, and it will lead us into talking about AI. You said part of it is because the era of AI is here.
Yeah.
So explain the decision to cut down, because a lot of companies, a lot of tech companies in particular, have been cutting down in a way that they haven't in a long time. And explain why AI was a catalyst for it.
Well, it's multiple factors. I mean, first, it's horrible and not what any CEO, not what anyone wants. And there are a few factors. I mean, first, like investments that made sense at the time kind of kept growing or sort of eventually kind of got out of position with the returns we were going to see. And so either we had, you know, built departments that were a little too big for what we needed or things like that. But I think something that really forced it was the shift to AI, where it's like, yeah, we're going to need a whole new set of we need to invest a lot more in things like Dropbox Dash, and that means we need to hire a new kind of we need a lot more AI engineers and just people of a different mix. And actually, that was the toughest part. It's like we needed to both like hire new people, but that we couldn't fit it in. We couldn't make the math work with the way that we were structured. So yeah, we had to make a really tough decision to let go of a lot of people and then make room to for the investments in AI and Dash and all the stuff that we wanted to ultimately make the company successful, but it's brutal.
That restructuring, right? There's a bunch of stuff we're doing. We can see the future is coming, right? That's sort of like right after the what you might call the ChatGPT moment.
Yeah.
Right? The light bulbs went off for everyone. Walk me through that part of the decision, right? You're like, oh, this happened. We see what's coming. I've got to flip the company. Is that a bunch of memos? Is that a long conversation?
It was one long memo that I wrote. Yep. I mean, that was how it was sort of – that was sort of the end of a – kind of thought process. But yeah, like I feel lucky. Like I was, you know, born into the PC era you know, I was in middle school and high school as the internet came along. Mobile and cloud like made Dropbox possible, right? Because like the second you have a smartphone is like the first time you have this issue of having two devices, like a laptop and a smartphone. Like, how do you deal with data? You know, AWS launched the year before Dropbox was founded. So we were just like, our board was like right at the center of two massive waves. And I remember what, you know, there's not a lot of good things about getting older, but you know, I'm 41 now. So I'm like, yeah, like I remember when I was 24 starting the company and like the tidal wave kind of feeling, and I'm like, it's happening again. And it's like very obvious that like things are different, you know, and it's going to shake everything up, make some things a lot more challenging and open up all kinds of new pathways for every company and folks that adapt quickly, like the new winners in the new era. And like, you know, Dropbox in a lot of ways should never have existed. You know, if you think about, we didn't own an operating system. We just had every weakness you could imagine, yet somehow here we are. So those are the most consequential periods in tech, because like every 10 years or so, the ground kind of unfreezes and like big changes, big sweeping changes are possible. And then things kind of harden up again after a few years. And so it was very clear, both like my lived experience and then also I love studying the history of tech and business and, you know, all kinds of things. But, you know, brought back to mind things like Andy Grove's Only the Paranoid Survive, like talking about how Intel navigated their transition from, they started out as a memory business and then mm-hmm. they found that there was a strategic inflection point where the world had changed and they basically had these competitors that were faster, better, cheaper than they were, putting them in a really tough spot. And so they decided to move to microprocessors. And Andy goes through that whole story in his book of like that difficulty, that transition, which sort of sounds good in hindsight because you're like, yeah, they lived happily ever after. But that's like saying like Google getting out of search, like Intel getting out of memory is like Google can't. That's just a crazy decision. So this is something in tech, like those periods, those strategic inflection points that Andy talks about are like the most important moments for our industry and in a tech company's life. So, you know, I had some experience going through that and having to surf those kinds of waves. And so it was very obvious after using ChatGPT, like, whoa, okay, we've like uncorked machine intelligence. Like, it's, let's go. And so, yeah, the mechanism I used was like writing a, you know, 3,500 page memo talking about how we need to shift Dropbox to being an AI first company. We need to launch Dash. We need to, you know, there's like all these, so ChatGPT and things like that are amazing, but there's a lot of questions it can't answer because it's not personalized to you. And, you know, there's a big void that Dropbox can fill by building personalized AI. So yeah, we got after it super quickly. And then one of the advantages of being founder and CEO and, you know, controlling shareholders, you can pivot the company pretty quickly. And that ended up being really important.
So I hear this comparison to this is mobile and social all over again, right? Mobile, social, cloud, mm-hmm. maybe. Half of it to me feels like it's super real. You can see it. You can see a bunch of new startups and new companies and new ideas and application models are moving from one place to another. And then part of me says this is wishful thinking and everyone just wants to get away from mobile phones because they're controlled by two dominant players. And boy, it would be cool if we could do something other than exist at the whims of the two dominant players.
Sure.
What's that mix in your head? Is it 50-50? Is it 80-20?
It's all the above. I mean, that's what makes these things so hard to navigate. It's like AI will be the best, AI will be the worst. Just like, you know, the printing press did great things, but you can write really bad things as a result.
But so I felt the same way about crypto, right? Like everyone wanted it to be, and I was just like, this is stupid.
I didn't. I was a crypto bearer. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're not that. You don't feel that way about this.
No, AI is going to – to me, it's clear that, you know, AI will be bigger than any of the transitions that, you know, the PC, cloud, mobile, internet.
Yeah.
Like it's more in like the fire or electricity, you know, or industrial revolution type category. But again, like that, this is why it's really important for founders to like study because like, when you're starting your first company, like everything is new to you. You think everything is like different. But then you zoom out with a historical perspective. You're like, oh, wait, no, these are like very obvious recurrent – you know, and there's the pattern, there's life cycles of companies of, you know, I think you can learn a lot about companies from actually studying like how empires rise and fall. Like there's actually a lot of same dynamics, like, oh, complacency, entitlement, like lack of hustle. Like
you get very big and then you do fail.
Yeah. And we were living that, honestly. But coming back to AI, like it is the real deal. I mean, the rise of like the silicon brain, that's like strong at, you know, we now have like a human brain and a silicon brain that are very complementary, all kinds of new opportunities for automation, all the benefits that we imagine are going to happen. And, you know, I think a lot of the challenges that we foresee or that challenges we've had in recent eras, like, you know, making sure these technologies are a force for good on balance. We're going to live that again. But you live that with every technology, yeah. Right? It's an awkward navigation, but we're going to go through that.
These previous transitions, cars, you could just like go build a car. And many companies have tried, many companies have failed, but they could start and produce a car. Mobile, right? You could just like build an app. You could download Xcode, you build an app, you could deploy it. AI, there's a whole bunch of dependencies. Where to start an AI company, you actually almost end up starting at OpenAI or Google, right? Or like someone who owns the H100s in a data center or Azure or something. That dependency feels different, right? If you're trying to compete with the AI companies, maybe the most reductive, common, I will get in trouble for saying this, but so many AI startups are like ChatGPT wrappers.
Yeah, they are.
You have a dependency on some of these models. Do you think, okay, part of the curve here is breaking away from those dependencies, or that will be the infrastructure that everybody uses?
Well, I think, you know, this is also why it's like super important for founders to understand like business and a lot of a lot of the curriculum you learn in business school is actually like very relevant. I mean, I never went to business school, so I can't really speak to that. But like,
ChatGPT summarize it for you.
Exactly. Well, I think it's a huge question of like, where is the value going to accrue, right?
And right now it's like to NVIDIA. The answer.
That's right. Because they have like the scarce resource, right? And I think it's also going to accrue to the people who have the relationship with the customer, so the application part of the stack. And then
– I think that's a good question for you. That feels less certain. Like it's certain that a lot of the value will accrue to NVIDIA. They make the chip that's in hottest demand.
Yep.
The customers paying money for the applications yet to be seen, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know that that is a definite in this whole mix.
It's interesting because you have sort of these like simultaneous positive and negative indicators. So like ChatGPT like speed ran from 0 to 100 million monthlies and probably $1 billion in revenue.
Yeah.
Faster than any product I can – probably faster than the iPhone. And yet it's also kind of like flattened out a little bit. And then, yes, like the amount of investment that has gone into AI versus the amount of like incremental engagement or revenue is like totally upside down. The way I think about that is – I mean, the internet is actually like a pretty comparable thing, which is like as soon as the internet came along, people's imaginations went wild. And even though the first experience was like very primitive, like it was even before like the web, like it was like maybe you could send an email. And that in and of itself was pretty cool and useful. Like I send a postcard around the world in 100 milliseconds, like it's unbelievable. But then a lot of farsighted people were like, guys, like this is going to change everything. We're going to get all our news on our computer. We're going to be able to watch any movie or music ever created. We're going to be able to have groceries delivered to our door. And then all those things turned out to be right, but they happened a lot later. The time constants they got wrong. So I think, keeping that in mind is really important. So and then specifically, along the way to the Spotify, there had to be a Napster and then the Kazaa and LimeWire and, Pandora. Where you had some false starts as a lot of the other stuff got ready, right? And like Netflix started out in DVD mailing because the broadband penetration and sort mm-hmm. of the enabling conditions and distribution. And so they had to kind of wait for that to catch up. Self-driving cars, a similar thing happened. Like, after it sort of became generally agreed that self-driving was going to be a thing, people were like, oh my God, in 10 minutes, no one's going to ever drive a car again. Everybody's going to be out of work. And like to this day, the best like self-driving thing most of us have used, like very few of us got here in a self-driving car, right? Or maybe have even been in a self-driving car, but all of us have Google Maps, right?
Yeah.
And so like Google Maps has probably had a bigger impact on driving than self-driving cars because these things kind of follow, people think that like level 5 autonomy or like a fully autonomous car is like step 1 when it's actually like step 100. And, only 10, 12 years after all this is this even starting to become real. So I think we're going to see the same dynamics with AI. There's this, again, like these MBA academic things. There are a lot of different frameworks out there where these hype cycles, right? The trough of disillusionment because mm-hmm. we had this like meteoric explosion in high expectations since the starting gun went off with ChatGPT. Yet that hasn't really translated to a lot of like new products or revenue other than ChatGPT. So there's going to be this big like crash of disappointment. You're already seeing AI companies sort of get off the rails and kind of implode. So like, but these are like very familiar rhythms and patterns in these tech cycles. So we're going to see all of that.
There's some very familiar criticisms. Dropbox has even faced a few of them, right? I have a Dropbox account. I put my data into your system. I have some amount of trust. Mm-hmm. The Dropbox isn't going to do anything with it. AI is all about taking action on the data. So Dash searches, I think you have some video editing features that are AI powered. Those necessarily involve like other people's models and data going in different places and being manipulated. How are you thinking? Because that feels like a big difference in kind. And there, I don't think the average consumer, particularly enterprise user, has a lot of trust in those controls yet.
So it's super important. Like that's the first thing on everyone's mind. Every customer's mind, first thing on our mind is like there are enormous like privacy, security, safety concerns with AI. And there were also enormous privacy, security, and safety concerns as we move our stuff in the cloud to begin with. And like, so this was not like a new phenomenon for us.
But I'll give you an example. Yeah. I think this is a very funny story in its way. The House of Representatives had to instruct its staffers this week to not use Microsoft Copilot.
Okay.
Because Microsoft is just rolling it out in the office suites. They all use Microsoft.
Yep.
Don't use it. Like, we're banning this tool is very – it seems fun to use. But like the work of the House of Representatives has like security clearance issues.
Of course.
Don't put it over there.
Yeah. And they're right.
But like that's like just to me like very funny, right?
Yeah.
Like Microsoft is like, here's this tool. And then the answer is you might be sharing classified information in a way that you should not be sharing.
Totally.
And so AI can like make bullet points out of it. That problem, it seems totally foreseeable, but also like impossible to foresee.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about that?
I mean, the same way that we were thinking about moving people's stuff to the cloud, to be honest. Like, it's super important to give people transparency and control and to really take ownership of the full stack and experience. And this happens all the time, too. Like, you know, as we move to, like, using our credit – sending our credit card number over the internet, you know, a lot of well-justified concern. So we're going to see the same thing happening with AI.
Yeah.
So transparency, like, well, how do these things actually work? Who's going to have access to the data? Like, and then give people control. Like, do I want to disable this entirely? Do I want to allow, you know, only these AI providers? Do I not want any third-party AI providers at all? Versus the opposite of like, oh, it's very like opaque, or companies don't give care to these issues, or sort of get, you know, blow themselves up on pretty predictable.
Yeah.
Obstacles. So we have a lot of experience. I mean, this is, you know, we've only dealt in these kinds of like existential concerns. So I think it's pretty familiar to us, but like transparency, control, and then educating people on like what's actually happening. And then as far as the AI stacks themselves, there's a lot of options, right? That you can use OpenAI or a lot of public cloud options. There have been phenomenal advances in open models and open source. So like the Llama models from Meta, but then there's a whole ton, you know, the gap between the closed source and open source models has been rapidly closing.
Would you transition right now? I think it's OpenAI that you use right now. Would you transition to running some of the open source models?
So we play with everything and we'll give customers choice. So it'll be yes and. Because we partner with OpenAI. And to be clear, we give our customers like very explicit like visibility and control. We only, whenever you're using any kind of AI feature, we only use AI for that specific purpose. And we have all these protections around and then like extra agreements and things with AI providers around like here's the rules of the road for how customer data is used. We launched Dropbox AI principles. We make a bunch of public commitments around here's what we do and don't do. So I think these are like table stakes things that are pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dropbox has a big advantage because we have this whole technical infrastructure, right? We operate one of the largest cloud infrastructures in the world, cloud services in the world. We were kind of the one car going the other direction, you know, so almost 10 years ago when we shifted from the public cloud to our own hosted infrastructure. The reasons we did that were to be able to have more control. It is more cost efficient. It also gives us a lot more performance. And then it's also very favorable as the AI world has come up because a lot of that stuff you'd do to build a giant hard drive for everyone is a lot of the same things you'd do to index the known universe of content and apps. And is it a lot of the same stuff you do to build like AI? So like large language model, like serving, fine tuning, inference, things like that. Those can build on a very similar foundation to what we already have, which is another big advantage that Dropbox has when deploying AI. So yes, we'll absolutely use open source models, but there's a lot of benefits to different closed source models. Your customers may have lots of different preferences in terms of who they want to work with and how they want to handle their data. And so for us, it'll be a lot of following what customers want, again, giving them transparency, control, choice.
At the beginning of the conversation, you talked about sorting out people's tabs and like helping them understand all the different containers on the internet. That sort of requires you to sit at a different layer in the computing stack, maybe at the browser layer, maybe somewhere else. Is that something you're like actively thinking about?
Totally, yeah. I mean, we really, you know, over the
years. Like Dropbox would build a browser so you can like help people get through the internet.
So we certainly are, well, we're in the browser in terms of an extension. So Dash just stepping back a little bit of what Dropbox Dash is. So basically Dash connects, it gives you AI-powered universal search. So what does that mean? Well, you connect, you wire up all your apps, you connect all the things that you want to be searchable. It gives you one search box, and it will search everything for you. And instead of having to go to every place manually, and then also will provide you like universal answers. So you can ask natural language questions like ChatGPT, and it'll give you answers. But we're also in the browser, so it's not just a search box. So when we, for customers that want it, we will give you a start page for work. And the idea there is to, you know, I was always just, I just look at when you hit new tab at work and in a normal browser, it's sort of like, what does it show you? It shows you like politics and news and sports and like tweets. And you're like, probably not, when you're not in work mode, that is what, that might be what you want. That's fine. But like when you're working, you're like, it's just, I'm trying to focus on something. And like, this is definitely not what I want to see. So why don't I have like a smarter like start page for work? So that's what we do. So we help you, we'll give you an overview of your day. We'll help surface like, hey, here's the stuff you've been working on a lot or that needs your attention. So kind of give you a better cockpit for work. We certainly have the technical capability to build a browser, but that's like a big customer request.
Well, the reason I'm at, well.
Yeah, but you're in the right direction. I think we're starting in the browser.
There are new interesting browsers totally. That are, for the first time in a long time, Arc.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
It's actually fascinating that there are browsers, like it's called the browser company.
Yeah, totally.
But there are companies chasing, okay, what does a reimagined browser for AI look like? And I'm just listening to you describe the vision, and it's like, why would you want to have some big dependency on Google or Microsoft or Apple to run your extension when there's like another thing there? And it's really those dependencies that you've been fighting against the whole time.
Totally.
You have a dependency on macOS not blocking Dropbox, right?
Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the day, and you know, every company's going to have dependencies, right? There's not really an option to sort of be fully self-contained. And at the end of the day, like, you know, you share customers with these companies, right? And if you're building something that millions of people want and are happy with, then, you know, it's not in the platform provider's interests. I mean, they can have sharp elbows. They can sort of disenfranchise you and cause a lot of problems for sure. But, you know, we've always tried to have like a collaborative relationship. And as long as you're providing customer value, then it's harder to do like flagrantly anti-competitive things. Harder, not impossible, to do flagrantly anti-competitive things.
Do you think the regulations we're seeing in Europe and some of the antitrust actions here will change your relationship to the big platform companies?
Well, I think we all want a level playing field. So yes, and I think things like a lot of the recent attention I think is good in terms of like forcing some level of interoperability and giving customers choice. I think these are all good things. Or, you know, I think it's a bad world if there's just a few platforms and they can not only, they can like control the entire experience and like own distribution and provide their own like first party alternatives, privilege them, tax their competitor. You know, it's like choose six of those things, not like all 15. You know? So I think that would be a good, you know, tipping or, you know, bending things back into a more kind of a spot that's better for innovation for sure. Because I think it'd be very hard to start the next Dropbox today, given the environment.
I think that's very true. And I think that's honestly one of the reasons I'm paying attention to both the platform shift to AI and the regulatory shift.
Totally.
Because the opportunities to create new kinds of companies, it feels more open than it has in a long time.
Yeah. I mean, there's still a lot of, like, my wish list is still, you know, pretty long. But no, yeah, it's important that, you know, the next great set of startups can be created. And it's not a great world if like all the innovation, if all the value of the innovation is kind of harvested by 50-year-old companies. I think that's just like not a great balance.
Yeah. Well, that's a really great place to leave it. You've given us more time than we bargained for. Drew, thank you so much for coming on Decoder.
No, thank you.
I'd like to thank Drew Houston for taking the time to join Decoder today. And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to let us know what you thought about this episode, or if you have any ideas for future episodes, hit us up. You can email us at decoder@theverge.com. We really do read all the emails. You can also hit me up directly on Threads. I'm @reckless1280. And we have a TikTok. It's @decoderpod. It is a surprising amount of fun. If you like Decoder, please share it with your friends, subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts. Decoder is a production of The Verge and part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Kate Cox and Nick Statt. It was edited by Callie Wright. Our supervising producer is Liam James. The Decoder music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We'll see you next time.